Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam. Bonjour. Hello, welcome to the Majlis podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. I'm your host, Adnan Hussein, director of MSGP and historian here at Queen's. And I'm really delighted today to have a conversation. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time with the author of a new and, I'm gathering, somewhat controversial book, a provocative re-envisioning of Islamic thought and practice and politics in a variety of really stimulating, engaging, challenging, and provocative ways that I think is going to have a big impact. So I'm delighted to have a chance to have at least this brief initial conversation. I know, since I know this figure quite well, that we could have what I think is a very important conversation for many, many hours. It's inexhaustible, the number of issues and the depth of knowledge and erudition and of deep critical, thought and engagement of Muhammad Abdu, who is Dr. Muhammad Abdu, author of this new book, Islam and Anarchism, Relationships and Resonances. Muhammad, welcome to the Majlis. Thanks so much for coming on. Maybe you can introduce yourself in your own words to our viewers and listeners.
Jazakallah khair, ya Adnan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. To you and virtual audience. My name is Muhammad Abdu. I'm a self-identifying Muslim anarchist and settler of color on Turtle Island of Arab, Egyptian, North African descent. I am also a postdoc at Cornell. I'm an assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Cairo. I did my PhD under your supervision. Social movement participant and activist post the Seattle 1999 anti-globalization movement. I moved to Canada as a settler in 1998. And then obviously was involved in the anti-war, anti-Iraq war, anti-Afghanistan war organizing. But I also spent time in Mexico with the Zapatistas on two separate occasions. And was involved, obviously, in the Tahrir uprisings and just social movements on Turtle Island, Mohawks in Tantanega, for instance, during the Culberstone Track incident. I think it was around 2004, 2005, Caledonia, and so on and so forth, and Indigenous and Black and Palestinian liberation. We'll just leave it at that.
Well, I mean, I think what your very brief, autobiographical situating and narrative there tells us is that you're somebody who has been involved and committed both to activism in these new social movements globally, as well as locally here in, where you did your PhD. And I'm delighted that you mentioned that, yes, we do have a pre-existing relationship of longstanding. But also that you're interested with this work in the academic and intellectual and theoretical and conceptual understanding of how Islam can relate or inform or be reinterpreted in light. So there's some kind of dialogue going on here between your activist political commitments and these intellectual interests that you have. So I'm curious, perhaps you could, in telling us a little bit about this book, firstly, before we get into the meat of, you know, your arguments and what you're doing, is first, just how did you come to write this book? What were you trying to accomplish with it? It's a unique and interesting kind of study to say, you know, that it's about Islam and anarchism. And the subtitle here is Relationships and Resonances. So maybe first, why did you want to write this book? And then what do you imagine this book is trying to do here? What are the relationships and resonances between these two things, Islam and anarchism?
Thank you for that question. So as a scholar activist and somebody who's been involved on the ground and does ethnography and historical archival research, as you know as well, and as many feminists, BIPOC feminists had taught, you know, including the late bell hooks, theory is a form of liberatory praxis, right? And it cannot be undermined. And it's a dual-pronged relationship that is constantly in dynamic relation to one another, insofar as theory and praxis. I'm a set of conjunctive ands, I'm not a set of disjunctive binary ors, and that's sort of part of what civilizational Western cultures of whiteness, modernity, try to impose on BIPOC people in general. How I came about this project really is involved with, or having been involved with, movements on the ground, particularly anarchist communities that tend to be, particularly in the context of Turtle Island, animated by white folks. And just organizing and feeling at the same time ostracization on account of my spirituality is a lot of Muslim leftists, let alone just general spiritual leftists, tend to feel within leftist circles, because they secularized, Christianized animations that tend, and it's part of the product of liberalism that tends, that seeps into even Marxism and anarchism within itself, an anti-religious and individualist sort of perspective. And I felt it became very important to address, not so much reconcile, because to me, Islam is always and has been anarchistic. So, and that's how I tend to identify. I don't necessarily associate myself with classical anarchism as it appeared, insofar as Eurocentric traditions, Emma Goldman, Bakunin, Kropotkin, and so on and so forth. And equally at the same time, I'm having to justify and validate my own existence to white audience and to BIPOC people that don't necessarily see spirituality also as necessarily related to politics. But as I said at a recent conference in Montreal, or the Anarchist Book Fair in Montreal, actually, the gathering, which was quite lovely, how can one love without spirit? How can one do anything without spirit? We associate spirit with non-human life, which a lot of leftists consider to be sacred and important and so on. And perhaps I drew a great deal of inspiration from, obviously, indigenous scholars that center spirituality within their own discourses, within their own ontological, epistemological way of relating to the land and non-human life and all their relations, quite frankly, something that Muslims should have done in the first place. I shudder to think that, subhanAllah, the Quran, we have many chapters, and I talk about this in the book, Surah Ar-Ra'd, Surah Ash-Shams, Surah Al-Nahl, Surah Al-Baqarah, named after non-human life. Yet Muslims, or very few Muslims, tend to think of their responsibilities towards non-human life as caretakers, as vicegerent, and as khulafa, an interesting concept that we can get into within itself and so on and so forth, as caretakers, not above, but rather in relationship to non-human life that our existence relies on. So to me, it was very organic. I wrote, the first version of this was written in 2009. It was an MA thesis with the fact that there were quite a few incarnations, actually, that existed on the block, probably three up until 2009. But then I obviously started my PhD, as you know, and Tahrir and involvement with the Zapatistas and just continued social movement organizing. And that led me to go back to the original MA thesis and reconfigure it, because the original MA thesis, which I regard as very rudimentary at this point, not even the skeleton, if that, of this. I mean, I didn't get into settler colonialism. I didn't talk about concepts, Islamic concepts, as the dawla, the ummah. I didn't talk about siyasa, you know, so far as the etymology of that, which literally translates into politics. I didn't talk about wataniya, qawmiya, third worldism, pan-Africanism, And so on, and a lot of events had happened to them. So it was a necessary revisioning of that project. I think that was overdue. I needed to talk about anti-blackness. I needed to talk about 1492 and the significance of that across the Atlantic, particularly when a third, fifth of the transatlantic slaves were Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula and west coast of Africa. That bears relevance. Muslim and black causes intersect. You know, El Shokat, and as you discussed, and Bird Nation, and some scholars have noted as well, Salman Sayyid, for instance, and others, that, Muslims and Jews were cast as savages, as heathens, as infidels, and so on and so forth, prior to the conquistador invasion of Turtle Island and the Americas, and so on and so forth. So particularly starting with the Caribbean. So yeah, all that was really necessary to address, to make sense of, in a way that I was about to say linear, but I'm trying to avoid the linear progressive teleological way of, at the same time, narrating matters in that regard. So that's how this came about. This book came about. Yeah, right. After 13 years, give or take.
So you had these, you know, long gestation and multiple inspirations and experiences that caused you to go to engage with Islamic concepts and find in them a different way of thinking through what it meant to be a Muslim, mm-hmm. what Islam is. And mm-hmm. In the book, you talk about your method for engaging with the foundational Islamic sources, so Quran, Sunnah, mm-hmm. Hadith, through mm-hmm. what you call anarcha ijtihad. And you also, the other concept that I think would be interesting at this stage, you know, kind of methodologically and what's involved in mm-hmm. reappraisal of Islamic sources and identification of these key concepts and mm-hmm. interpretation of them is also seeing the Quran as a Quran of the oppressed. In other words, mm-hmm. a kind of social justice interpretation mm-hmm. and understanding of the Quran and the Quranic message. So could you tell, you know, listeners a little bit about what is anarcha ijtihad? How do you engage mm-hmm. with interpretation of these sources? Mm-hmm. How have you developed that? And then we can talk maybe a little bit more about, you know, what does a Quran of the oppressed reveal when we talk about mm-hmm. particular kinds of issues that you discuss in the book after that, after first hearing a little bit about anarcha ijtihad, your method? Sure.
So as a muhajir, as a migrant, and again, as a settler, because that becomes very core, part of the responsibility, and perhaps, you know, this is the horizon of settler colonialism within itself, it does allow a certain room for the reimagination of oneself, one's identity, particularly in Ghurba, in the estrangement of living in a predominantly non-Muslim society. And I do recall being at Renewing the Anarchist Tradition conferences and so on and so forth, that if this is to work, if there's going to be a reinterpretation of Islam on a political theological level, in the lines of what Malcolm, what Martin, what many others were trying to do, Tolstoy, Dorothy Day, Jacques Ellul, because I mean, there are religious and spiritual leftists, then I need to deal with the original texts. I need to deal particularly with the Quran. I need to show, I need to actually show that Islam and Quran particularly, not to dismiss the hadith, the oral tradition, and so on and so forth, and, you know, the entire folklore of culture, thaqafa, that exists within and over the span of 1,400 and now 42, 43 years of Muslim history. We're certainly not monolithic communities, and there's not a monolithic Islam within itself. There are over 73 interpretations of it. So my responsibility was, vis-a-vis a methodology referred to as anarchic ijtihad, to begin to re-engage the Quran as an Arabic speaker, somebody who studied, who learned, whose first language is Arabic, and so on and so forth, and to trace ontologically, epistemologically, certain concepts, certain understandings. Because my contention is that Muslims don't understand what the nation state is. They don't understand what capitalism is. And this is why we find a lot of Muslims will come about and say, well, Marxism is haram, for instance, right? Because Islam allows, for instance, private property. But then they conflate capitalism with markets or free markets. as Manuel de Landa had written in one of his essays. So anarchic ijtihad is a methodology whereby whenever I read the Quran, I am looking at the central foundational principles, because I also that inform from what does Islam say about authority? What does Islam say about economics, about governance? There are certain things that are determined from a micro-political level, a macroeconomic level, and a microeconomic level that have to be also in conjunction, because again, this is a holistic system. When the Prophet ﷺ came, as all prophets, as all messengers, arguably they did not come with the message of you need to do this and you need to do that. You need to wear the hijab, you need to bend your body to pray and praise to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala 5 times, and so on and so forth. Otherwise, folks would not have followed. What they came was to lay down the social justice foundations. They needed to make sure that people had shelter, had food, had clothing, that the renewed spirit of internal jihad, of a revolutionary becoming, had been internalized, such that this new foundation of this new polity was set into place, so that they were able to engage in more tangential conversations. Unfortunately, we live in a day and age where we're looking at the branches of the tree and we're forgetting the trunk. Of course, both are important, but the trunk becomes very, very important. And adal ijtima'iyya, or social justice, is central and core to Islam, arguably all faiths, particularly monotheistic ones. So Islam forbids riba. Islam talks about the concept that we're all khulafa. Okay, well, that is what anarchic ijtihad becomes useful. It is a search for anarchistic, anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, anti-sexist, anti-racist, and so on and so forth, anti-ableist concepts that inform Islam ontologically, epistemologically, and starts from that foundation. I start, obviously, from the foundation of anti-capitalism and anti-authoritarianism, and not just anti-statism. Because of other concepts such as tawheed and belief in a single creator and not associating anybody with that creator, anything with that creator, not a flag, not a nation, not a family, not the worship of kin, not the worship of children, not the worship of money. So that's what anarchic ijtihad becomes useful for. And it allows this room for the constant reinterpretation of Islam. And this is where I would come and say that it's not just anarchism that I'm looking at. I'm looking specifically at post-structuralist anarchism that tends to be less antagonistic towards religion, that understands power is diffuse. It's not just top-down. It's rhizomatic. It exists everywhere. There's power right here, right now, across us in terms of the various privileges and the asymmetries that we enjoy in relationship to one another, right? Why I would want to organize that vertically into a nation state and so on from a Marxist perspective, or to take over the state in order to institute some kind of liberationist project, that becomes a whole different other realm of discussion as to why then anarchism and not Marxism. But that also has to deal with Muslims having their own governance structures, to be quite honest, that we should feel proud of, just as much as Black, Indigenous, and people of color. While we may learn a lot of things from Marx, from anarchism or classical anarchism, but we have our own intellectual bodies of knowledge, oral traditions, and so on and so forth, that do provide us with alternative ways of living that existed in quote-unquote the medieval period or the pre-modern period. I'm not fetishizing and I'm not romanticizing that period, and Muslims made a lot of mistakes. But this is what anarchic ijtihad is useful for. It is useful not only vis-a-vis the Quran, as I said, and extracting not only the anti-capitalist and anti-authoritarian, but also non-authoritarian, because it's one thing to be anti-something in a rhetorical level. It's a different thing altogether, extracting the non-capitalist and non-authoritarian concepts, practices in my own tradition, and beginning to embody them on the ground. So when we talk about, when I begin to talk about things like, for instance, given anti-Blackness and Arab supremacy that exists within predominantly Muslim societies, Egypt being one of them, for instance, shamefully so, right? Despite Black Nubian, or despite Nubian Egyptians, despite Sudanese Egyptians, and so on and so forth. And again, I discuss all this sort of stuff. Anarchic ijtihad becomes useful in these kinds of instances, because in the wake of Black Lives Matter, for instance, we started seeing in movies like Black Panther, the reinvigoration of Hollywoodian characterization, stereotypes that even scholars obviously have bought into, in terms of, well, you Arabs are no different in terms of your slave trade than the Europeans did during the Middle Passage, and so on and so forth. So anarchic ijtihad becomes useful to say, well, wait a second, I'm not condoning slavery during the pre-modern period, and that Muslims participated in it just as much as Jews, and so on and so forth. But the meaning of slavery, as Kisha Ali, as a lot of scholars had so noted, varied. It wasn't racialized. We didn't have a political economy that relied on enslavement to the majority of slaves were Circassians. Slaves had rights, and so on. Again, this is not to condone slavery whatsoever, but to add a certain nuance to these kinds of discussions. And that's what anarchic ijtihad becomes useful for. Again, whether it's dealing with anti-capitalist or anti-authoritarian or whatever commitments that are ever evolving as part of this reinterpretation. There are more blank spaces on a page than with Train and Black. The Quran, as you know, is a text that 60% of it almost is filled with metaphors, parables, calling on not only Muslims, because again, this is the beauty of the language and having access and knowledge of the language within itself. God speaks in the Quran to Muslims, absolutely, and God is not shy, because there is a lot of verses where God says, "Ya ayyuhal muslimina wal muslimat." But in other verses, God speaks more broadly and says, "Ya ayyuhal mu'minina wal mu'minat," O believers, in the broadest possible sense. So what are the ontological, epistemological, then, commitments that define who and what is a believer? Whether you're a Muslim or you're not. That becomes a question, because if the original polity that Muhammad had established vis-a-vis the Medina Charter, Mithaq al-Medina, and so on, and the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, included Muslims, Jews, Zoroastrians, and so on and so forth, folks that were non-Muslim, that means that that ummah, that community, is a community of believers. But who are attached together, and this is the membrane that holds them together vis-a-vis commitments that they hold in relationship to one another, particularly to social justice. This commits. So this is becomes the project. I needed to go and decolonize Islam away from the Orientalist and fundamentalist interpretations that exist, the liberal progressive. I want to be a good hyphenated American, Muslim American citizen, Black American citizen, and so on and so forth, that only reinforces settler colonialism and indigenous dispossession.
Okay, so let me...
And at the same time, sorry, get rid of boxes. So anarchic ijtihad is useful in that sense. Sorry for prolonging that.
No. That's great. I mean, but I'm interested in how, since you introduced the concept here of an ummah, a community or polity of some kind of believers, rather than, say, Muslims, how you understand and define that concept as embedded in Quranic sources, because you just critiqued, and we didn't go far into it, but you were just critiquing the way in which certain forms of Muslim identity, particularly Muslims in the diaspora, have imported all kinds of concepts and ideas that are convenient for trying to, you know, integrate oneself into, say, you know, a liberal nation state, capitalist order. And so that affects the way they're trying to rationalize or interpret Islam to, you know, fit within these circumstances in some fashion. And what you're trying to do is decolonize from Orientalist and other. We might also add, I mean, you seem to also be taking issue with a lot of previous Muslim traditions of interpretation, of consensus on various topics and so on. So in decolonizing this, as you say, from that, you're also, of course, having to unpack, you know, maybe histories of Muslim traditional assumptions and interpretations to get at this concept in a new way. So what do you, for using an example of the ummah, how does an anarchic ijtihad interpretation of the concept of the ummah unfold? What do you see? What are the outcomes of that interpretation using anarcha ijtihad?
So I definitely draw on folks and scholars, incredible scholars, actually, like Tamim Barhouti, a Palestinian Egyptian scholar, who wrote a book called The Ummah and the Dawla, and I draw on folks like Wael Hallaq, who wrote The Impossible State, and so on. The Ummah represented a confederacy. There was no centralized authority within the Muslim Ummah and throughout the span of 1,443 years.
But let's stop for a second. I mean, in the period that we're, I mean, there's a lot of different periods. I mean, you are also very critical of the post-prophetic period for a lot of imperial and hierarchical and conservative sorts of interpretations that have been elaborated in Muslim tradition and certainly Muslim history after the prophet. You would say you're not grounding it, you know, well, that would be an interesting conversation to have, is what you think can be gained, what, you know, how do you interpret, like, you know, the intellectual tradition that has unfolded. But your fundamental claim for Anarka Ijtihad is looking at these early sources that are canonical to Muslims. Muslims all agree, you know, that we should look at the Quran and the Hadith principally. I mean, there's some outliers and we can talk about that. But fundamentally, you're going back to the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's era, and the evidence that we have for that period's practice. Wouldn't you say that during that era, it's a very atypical and exceptional period, given that you have, you know, access to revelation, like the prophet is the authority there. And in fact, actually all of those early documents about conversion or about the ittifaqs, the mithaqs, the treaties that are, that are, you know, created, the Pact of Medina, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah that you already referenced, they all do say that adherence or parties to this treaty, maybe not in Hudaybiyah because it's, you know, between groups that don't recognize, but is that they recognize that Muhammad is Rasulullah, right? So there is some kind of a recognition that there is some authority that is not the same or equal to everybody else who's part of the community of believers. How do you deal with that issue? What is the nature of prophetic authority in your anti-authority, you know, reading of Islam through Anarka Ijtihad?
So one of the things that I do address is obviously the authority of God and the authority of the Prophet, because it becomes something that's very important. But as the Quran says, Muhammadan illa rasulun ja'a min qablihi rusul, Muhammad is nothing but the Prophet. So Muhammad is not somebody that is worshipped. And Muhammad conducted, and this is the embodiment of Islam and what made him an incredible example for Muslims. Anti-authoritarian tendencies. Muhammad did not dictate, as much as Muhammad also sought counsel. Muhammad engaged in shura. In the Quran, we have the chapter of shura, so mutual consultation, and constantly did so with members of the community, within and without, Muslims and non-Muslims. Muhammad engaged in ijma', which is another anti-authoritarian and non-authoritarian concept. Ijma', community consensus. Well, there's another sort of, again, anarchistic concept.
Right.
We talked about shura, ijma', but then there's maslaha. What is beneficial to the collective community within itself? So I'm not requiring, because again, there are different paths to the same creator, and Islam itself, the Quran acknowledges that. وَلَا جُنَاحٌ عَلَى الْيَهُودُ وَالنَّصَارَى. And the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians shall not fear what happens to them on the day of judgment, because they are believers. So Muhammad becomes a vehicle and a prophet for transmission. Muhammad, yes, was not fallible in the way that a lot of us as human beings are fallible. But there are instances in the Quran, for instance, when Jibreel alayhi salam took the image of the an old man and the Prophet alayhi salam was in supposedly an important gathering, and the elderly man that Jibreel took the image of was also blind, and tried to, I think, gesture to the Prophet alayhi salam to grasp his attention, but the Prophet didn't pay attention or ignored, and then immediately the verse with revealed wa'abatha wa tawalla anjahu al-am, right? Which is, you know, how dare you and Muhammad think that, and why would you presume that this blind man that came into your supposedly prestigious or important gathering does not bring what is worthy of importance and attention, that you would not leave that gathering and attend to that? So this is not to say, again, that the Prophet is fallible in the same way that we are as human beings. Prophets are prophets. They are picked for particular reasons, for their exceptionalism, absolutely, and because they are purified in certain ways as guides. But they always permitted, listened, counseled. And to me, that represents the moment for the contestation of their own authority as centralized figures that simply transmit orders that folks are supposed to follow. And that's the difference. So Islam is not an organized, institutionalized religion that way. And it's not meant, because ijtihad is the right of all Muslims to participate in, right? And we can sit down and talk about the obstacles about that in the contemporary and so on, and the myth of the closing of the door of ijtihad during supposedly the Abbasid period and so on, but nobody could close that door because this is the right of any Muslim. And what's astonishing is that, as you know, the Quran has a lot of verses. For instance, chapter 2 in the Quran begins with Alif Lam Mim, three Arabic letters conjoined to form an Arabic word that nobody knows the meaning of. So it's not a literalist text, again, as folks would presume. Words can change meaning from one verse to another, as in other languages. And that's what allows room for interpretation. And that is what allows room for the contestation of whatever authority figures that existed prior to in other situations, in other circumstances, because Islam also distinguishes between morals and ethics, al-aqa'id within itself, wal-usul. What may not be ethical in one situation will not be necessarily ethical in another situation, and so on and so forth. So it does allow for that room, for that constant interpretation, and to go back to the Prophet. The Prophet just reveals that message and the completed message is there, but that doesn't mean that folks are not supposed to continue on with that interpretive form, which of course Muslims have proven that they did engage in that interpretive form, which means that Islam, yes, it's complete, but it's always subject to interpretation and reinterpretation because circumstances change.
So yes, indeed.
That answers your question. Kind of roundabout way.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's the book does in a couple of chapters lot on this these concepts that you were introducing now about finding within Muslim tradition and particularly in the Quran principles, concepts and principles that lead to an anti-authoritarian approach to understanding the religion and you know, what follows from its ethical principles, like you mentioned Shura and these occasions that you also mentioned where the Prophet's judgment is being modulated or moderated by the divine correction as an exemplary way of saying this is the vessel and the vehicle for the transmission, but it's establishing that there is exclusive authority, you know, with God, God's sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so human sovereignty is always mediated. And I very much like your idea that this idea that through anarcha-ijtihad, you're trying to recover a kind of sense of the ethical and spiritual capacity that all Muslims are supposed to have as adherents for, you know, engaging in a living way in the tradition. So that seems very much like a profound, you know, case that you're trying to make here for an anti-authoritarian interpretation of Islam. But you also had a, since we were talking about the idea of the ummah, at the end of that chapter about the anti and non-authoritarian Islam, you have a subsection that is Muslim and non-Muslim glossaries of indigeneity towards a resurgent ummah, anti-blackness and anti-indigenous politics. So now that you've grounded that there is this way of understanding these concepts of religious authority and it's this equitable, horizontal, anarcha, you know, manner, what is your call here? I mean, how do you see these solidarities being forged you know, between the Muslim and the non-Muslim in this resurgent ummah? What are you calling for here? What is that subsection really about?
Well, as Dr. Eve Tuck had taught and written in her very well-known essay alongside with Wayne Yang, decolonization isn't a metaphor, it is material. It has to be connected to land. It has to be connected to our traditions. Anti-blackness is very real within Muslim communities, whether within the diaspora or predominantly Muslim nations. But Muslims come here and, if, you know, and this is the irony. And let me just take this example, albeit slightly controversial, although I think I slightly touched on it. I find it incredibly hypocritical, to be quite frank, that Muslims particularly would go out, would engage in direct action, which I'm very much all for in street protests. Free Palestine, given the settler colonial occupation, but they don't recognize that they are participating in settler colonialism themselves, in the emplacement and replacement of indigenous people, because of settler colonialism is an ongoing project. It's a genocide that is ongoing. And so it is slavery, as Sadia Hartman had noted, afterlife to slavery projects, that your ground laws, and so on and so forth. So if we're being truthful, there is a neglected responsibility because we are coming here and pledging allegiance, and particularly one witness is in the US. And I remember Trump at a certain point, quite intelligently actually, had I think it was a ceremony to initiate a bunch of new citizens, and four of them were people of color, of course. One of them was hijabi, one was from Sudan, I think another from South Asia, and pledging allegiance to defend the nation. And Wael Hallaq, of course, talks about this because this nation is not certainly heathenless or godless. It is a secularized Christianity that animates its Protestant laws that concern property, in God we trust, on a $1 bill, and so on and so forth. So, no, there is a God. It's a liberal, secularized Christian God. And we are pledging allegiance vis-a-vis patriotism, which I distinguish slightly from nationalism, vis-a-vis the vehicle that patriotism tends to be attached to, although nationalism facilitates that because it tends to be attached to the state, that I'm a proud Muslim American. I'm a proud Black American. But the only person that does not have to hyphenate their American identity, apparently, is the white American. They are simply the Native Americans, right? Or supposedly the Native Americans. And I find it quite ironic, this, because to me that breaks tawhid. And of course we have more contemporary but classical Muslim scholars, and I get into this, Fazlur Rahman and Mawdudi, Iqbal, and so on and so forth. Some were far more militant like Mawdudi than others, who got into the debate as to whether a Muslim can be a nationalist or not within their own society, let alone otherwise. Right? And some of them went back because to them they were also trying to use the Muslim nationalism theme as a means to take over the state in a Muslim Brotherhood kind of way, in an Ikhwan kind of way, to use that as a vehicle to achieve the Ummah. But again, if we go back to classical sources, the Ummah cannot be achieved through certainly another modern nation state because sovereignty lies in the Ummah. It's non-territorial. And the state does not correspond to what most Arabs or Muslims, when they are asked what is the term for state, they would say dawla. Well, dawla does not actually mean state, right? And it cannot be used to achieve the ummah. And that's a different discussion that we can get into in more detail. But there is an abdicated responsibility. It is not sufficient to simply, say, well, we're going to support indigenous people, but support and how? Supporting means reiterating the stolen land, means land back, means reparations for Black people, particularly descendants of the transatlantic and middle passage. It's dealing with Black on Black ethnocentrism. That's what supporting an allyship means. And if you're not willing to go that far, then as far as I'm concerned, you're neglecting your responsibility as somebody who is engaged in Hijra. And this is particularly becomes the problem. Is not only amongst Muslims, but to be quite frank, Muslim leftists who believe that the state that is inseparable, as historians have told us, as political philosophers have told us, post-structuralist philosophers have told us, Ferdinand Braudel, historians have told us, etc., it is inseparable from racial capitalism. Historically so. The two could not have evolved without one another. So a lot of Muslims will end up being, particularly in this woke moment, progressive, and by that I very much distinguish from being radical, but buying into progressive social justice politics, which is nice and wonderful, but it also means that I'm going to join the AOC squad Bernie crowd in the sense that I'm going to try and reform the state. But the state is a settler state, and the state, as political philosophy determined, it functions upon the lowest common denominator of interest to elect a party, to elect a leader. It is vertically organized as a state, particularly in a post-Snowden era, where there's surveillance, there's control, and not just discipline, and so on. And it's a military-industrial complex, and you have racial capitalism and pharmaceutical-industrial complexes and agro-industrial complexes, and right, you're somehow going to eliminate all that and keep the state and be able to, in some kind of revolutionary Marxist fashion, take it over. And that's from the progressive standpoint again, and to make it into something that is more open, more socialist-y, and so on, as opposed to what social movements have taught, particularly since Seattle, examples including the Zapatistas, examples including the 18 Days of Tahrir, that you don't need the state. What you do need, and this was the mistake of Tahrir, and I said it to them, is a bunch of human beings, even if they are small in number, and even if, and even better, if they come from diverse, different backgrounds, political positionings, that they re-examine the ethical, political traditions that informs their own sense of embraced identities. And this is also the limits of identity politics that way. But the moment I begin to buy in an American identity, a Canadian identity, I'm literally pledging my allegiance to the state, the imperial state, the settler colonial state, again, that displaced me and caused me to engage in hijra in the first place. And now I'm complicit in the oppression of other people. And it's not a matter of an oppression Olympics or competition between struggles, because all our fires are connected. It is a matter of then understanding what those connections are and building upon them. And that involves determining what the ethical political commitments that define who and what is a Muslim, who and what is a mu'min, who is what is black, who and what is Jewish, Christian. To me, just because you call yourself a Muslim doesn't make you a part of my ummah, or an anarchist for that matter, or a Jew. If you're a Zionist Jew, sorry, I'm not interested. Your ethical political commitments contradict mine. But you are, if you're Jewish, who are anti-Zionist, who are committed to Palestinian liberation, especially if you're a settler on Turtle Island, or committed to indigenous liberation, to black liberation, and so on and so forth, that becomes a different story. If you're a Muslim who's a capitalist, who's a misogynist, who beats their wives, who acts like a dictator, an authoritarian, everything, then forget it, you're not a Muslim to me. At least you're not the one that fits into my conceptualization of the ummah. So this is where that section begins to discuss. I begin to, first of all, pick up on debates within indigenous and black studies, because there are huge debates in people of color as to who and what is a settler. And of course, we have categories as settler, indigenous, or native, slave. But then I also extend to that to include what Jody Bird refers to as the arrivals. Mm-hmm. Particularly insofar as migrants who have been displaced. And I begin to talk about the difference between settler privilege and settler benefits and so on and so forth, but even pick up on concepts as indigeneity, which I take not as a racial concept within itself, but actually build on people like Jeanette Armstrong, Benita Lawrence, Zainab Amadahi, Bob Loveless, and begin to construct of it indigeneity as a kind of fitra, a return to a nascent state of being that we felt insofar as the womb. No child is born a misogynist. Bin Laden wasn't born Bin Laden. Baghdadi wasn't born Baghdadi, and so on. We are made into the monsters that we become vis-a-vis the socializations of the world that we're exposed to, and so on and so forth, right? But that original conditioning that we are born in the state of fitra, we're born to do good, unlike the concept of original sin within Christianity. We're born to do good. We're born inclined to connect with communities, with non-human life, and it is the desire in a certain sense to extract again the conditioning of that vis-a-vis the concept of fitra or indigeneity. But that also has to deal with community and land, because you can't do that in isolation either. It's not about some narcissistic individualist affair, right? It's just very much like healing or growing my little community garden or my little garden in my backyard. No, it involves a politics of responsibility. Unfortunately, most states function, if not all states, function through a politics of rights, a politics of exclusion that way. I was about to draw on again then as well, but not to get too philosophical. No, this is about siyasat al-mas'uliyyah, politics of responsibility. You don't have rights until you have responsibilities to others. But Muslims aren't paying attention to their responsibilities to other people that are non-Muslim or lands that they live, that they reap accrue benefits from at the expense of other people who don't have access to the same privileges, who are denied and, yeah, were treated, you know, less than animals. And I understand, of course, we're targets of Islamophobia, but this is where 1492 becomes very important. But I'm not out to fetishize. I'm sorry, it's very shameful that, you know, and this is why I'm in awe, not to romanticize again. I'm in awe of indigenous people, given the fact that everything was stolen from them, their lands, their traditions, their experience, residential schools, their languages. everything. And yet, the determination, the valor, the resurgence. We Muslims, we have everything. We have our land, we have our resources, we have our languages, we have the Quran, we have our traditions. What do we lack? We lack the azima, we lack the will, we lack the revolutionary impetus to engage in tajdeed, because all we're concerned about is taqlid. Mm-hmm. We want the technology of the West, we want the military of the West, the might, the medical, etc., economic. And we don't consider that it may be contradictory, but no, we don't want to question things like queerness. We don't want to talk about feminism. We don't want to talk about authoritarianism. We don't want to talk about any of that stuff because we consider it to be antithetical. And so we neither understand our own traditions nor understand that of the West's. And you have to have a command of both, in my humble opinion. What is more devastating that even Daesh at its height, that considered Al-Qaeda to be soft, and this is the irony behind a war of terror and sort of the psychoaffective violence that colonized people, because we are manufactured into terrorists, right? And that's what the war on terror is. It's a war on Islam, and it has a true prompt. It's racialized insofar as a Black Islam, an African Islam, and Enlightenment scholars really knew this. They understood what they were doing because we couldn't be defeated in three consecutive sort of recurring crusades, if you will. So we have to be destroyed from within. And of course, the sectarian Islam, the Shiite Islam, the Ismaili Islam, the Sufi Islam, the Sunni Islam, and let them bash against one another. But my point being is that within this dilemma of ours is what is more catastrophic than Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and Daesh, who are supposedly so well-versed within Islamic studies that they were referred to themselves as a Dawla Islami. Again, there is no concept of the state within Islam. Dawla falls between Dar and Zal, and it exists in the Quran in two or three verses. And I talk about those verses, and I talk about its evolution, right? And there was always, there could even be, at least in the pre-modern period, a multiplicity of Dawlas. But within one dawla, loosely, like I said, resembling a decentralized confederacy that's Quranically referred to as, in a certain sense, the Ummah. So there is no such thing as the Islamic State. The state is a modern concept. The chapter 59, of, for instance, of the Quran, the Surah Al-Hashr, the gathering, verse 7, for instance, talks about the dawla in that sense. For example, it speaks of the Prophet's distribution of the spoils of war to those in need, so that it may not reside within singular hands. It may, so that therefore it may make a circuit, a dawlatun, amongst you. Again, to establish more of an equitable, egalitarian, economic situation. It's also used in the Quranic verse in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the chapter of Imran, I believe, in verse 140, where God discusses the cyclical nation of human vicissitudes, such that the triumphant day is replaced by defeat of another, just as much as one may be healthy one day and unhealthy another. So yeah, we very much lack even understanding of our own traditions, our own concepts and practices within Islam. And we lack an understanding of the West when a lot of Muslims, traditional Muslims, and I saw this debate, with a Marxist Muslim the other day, and so on, where he was just very, very frustrated with a lot of traditionalist Muslims that were saying, well, Marxism is haram. But this is where the political, theological understanding of the Quran and being able to, again, deal with one's own traditions becomes very, very important in order to establish those relations with indigenous people, with Black people, and understand one's responsibilities towards non-human life and be able to deal with the facade that exists within our own community. So we all have many Obamas and many Trumps within us. So yeah, where's the jihad al-akbar that way?
Right. Well, I mean, okay, this raises an interesting, issue or question, because it does put, say, post-Quranic or post, revelation period Muslim history into a big problem, because, as you may say, that there isn't this institutional or conceptual history to something called the Islamic State. This is something that's clearly a construct of the modern nation state era, where Muslims are interpreting what they mean for the ideal Muslim society, or how to live Islam and institute it in a collective form, is always being mediated through the pre-existing, historically created and imposed structure of the nation state. However, before that period of the modern nation state, there were lots of forms of Muslim governance, that is Muslim rulers, you know, ruled over dynastic states and, you know, patrimonial, household built states. And you know, the Ottomans, of course, had a very highly functioning bureaucratic form of administration for the Ottoman imperial state and so on. So even from the very earliest periods after the prophetic period, there were some decisions that were clearly made in how to organize the collectivity, the polity of the Ummah in various ways that transformed into dynastic empires. But what I wonder is, partly, isn't that an outcome of the fact that, you know, Muslims conquered these territories and lands in these earlier, in these early periods? They encountered and had to, or found themselves charged with the situation of governing cities and, you know, large territories that were not operating under kind of the mechanisms that you could have in the smaller face-to-face communities of the Arabian Peninsula at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in tribal kind of Arabia. But these were settled kind of areas that had a tradition of states, of hierarchical political organization, social subordination, and so on. So how do you, you know, kind of peel back, you know, what was it just impossible in that time to fulfill, you know, on a broader scale? I mean, how can you imagine, or is it, or is that history really more just a cautionary sort of tale about the susceptibility of the Muslim, of Islam and the Quranic message that you're developing in Arka Ijtihad, its susceptibility at all times in history for being kind of interpreted in a manner that reconciles it to established hierarchies and political powers, and that you need a continuous radical kind of tradition. You're providing a reminder and a re-engagement with that radical tradition that has maybe never been the dominant one after the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So is that how you see it? How do you wrestle with the fact that history doesn't necessarily validate the idea that these interpretations could and did lead to egalitarian, non-hierarchical, anarchic social and political structures in Islam?
So that's a very loaded question, but I'm obviously glad because I can answer that in a multiplicity of different ways, in simple but also very complicated ways. Let me start off by saying that definitely despotism, nepotism, the neglect of the traditional foundations, the expansion of Muslim territories vis-a-vis conquest. Most of the conquests, I would argue, as a lot of anti-Orientalist scholars have argued, was not necessarily by the sword, although there were certainly incidents of that. There are a lot that were drawn, though, to Islam vis-a-vis the social justice principles that existed within it. And Islam
mitigated. Have to talk about conversion of Muslims. That's a different issue. But Muslims conquered areas and then now we're governing. So they may have been a small minority, but they're now wielding power. How they decide to do that. Yeah.
But the interesting thing is that despite that occurred, because you didn't have borders, because yes, hierarchies existed, but then Muslims held and preserved the right to ijtihad, and scholars particularly to challenge that despotic rule. And there are many incidences, of course, within Muslim history in which that occurred to various different degrees of consequences to the Muslim scholar, because again, you're interpreting and you're engaging in an inherently political interpretation, right, of Islam. And hence you're challenging that kind of despotism and nepotism. That was more fluid in the sense because you didn't, again, have definable borders. If you didn't like a particular territory, you can migrate and move and so on and so forth. How Ibn Battuta ended up in the journeys that he ended up in and so on and so forth, right? Ibn Khaldun sitting down and analyzing, despite whatever anti-blackness, but in al-Muqaddimah sitting down and analyzing sort of the rise and fall and commenting, obviously, on the dynastic rules and so on and so forth. So definitely Muslims got arrogance. And that is part of the problem. And I really think it begins gradually from the Prophet's death, alayhi salatu wasalam, and this is where, arguably, I mean, you know, the sort of like Sunni Shiite split that begins to sort of takes more of an exacerbated form as time progresses. Of course, we have the Kharijites, the Najdites, etc., that contemplated the fact that the original quote-unquote Muslim anarchists, why the need for a leader? And we could sit down and talk about what the Prophet was asked on his deathbed, who shall lead us in prayers? But leading the prayers always shifts, true, and we know this, right? And the ultimate imam, as I say in the Quran, is the guide, because it comes from the root M. What is our guide? The Quran. If nobody holistically knows everything, and the Prophet is dead, in the absence of the Prophet, we all interpret. Therefore, what guides us, and what distinguishes between the validity or invalidity of my argument versus your argument, lies within the Quran.
Right. So that was the argument that, like, Al-Ghazali made in his refutation of the, you know, of the Ismaili doctrine, right?
Precisely.
Yes, but exactly.
But the interesting thing is that even when I come to take the four Khulafa al-Rashideen, Omar, Uthman, Abu Bakr, and Ali, they all remained within each other's council. They did not act as dictators. Obviously, with... And three of them were murdered. Three of them were killed by Muslims, of course. So that is the risk. But that's also the beauty. Because what you're honoring is honoring the message of Islam, honoring the ethical political commitments of Islam, not following your whims in order to achieve, again, and attain some degree of power, political, theological power, in order to rule over others. This is why Ali did not want vengeance for his own murder and his own killing, and so on and so forth. So, and they remained within each other's council, and not only those four khulafa, but within the muhaddithat, the women that existed, the wives of the Prophet, and of course, Aisha went to meet Ali on the battlefield, the wife of the Prophet. So this is the degree in which power was diffused still. And it still remained diffused, I would arguably, for the majority of that 1,400, because despite the despotism, you still could migrate, you still could move, you could contest, you could challenge, and so on and so forth. And if you came up with an Islamic interpretation that Muslims abided by, and so on and so forth, then you have the capacity for revolt. The game becomes altogether very different in modernity, obviously, because the societies of control, of surveillance, of politics of citizenship, of border control, of border imperialism, really, as Hershel Walia notes it, and so on, and the necessity then to think outside the mold of nation states. That becomes the difference over here. You know, anybody could issue a fatwa, as you know, whether people follow that fatwa or not, that's altogether a different story. And we can, I mean, Iran had a fatwa with regards to Salman Rushdie, and, you know, we saw what happened recently. So when a fatwa is followed, whether people follow it or whatever it may be, that becomes the question. But it also has practical consequences, if I may, in the contemporary. Because as I say in the context of Tahrir, or even in the context of Palestine, if Palestine was free tomorrow, would it be a one state? What kind of state would it be? Would it be a secular state? Would it be then the PLO and Fatah versus Hamas and Islamic Jihad? Because one will
already
is,
want, you know, even without liberation.
Right? Yeah. So again, dealing with the political theological, where are the Palestinian queers then going to fall? So this question of spirituality, and I have no problem again with Muslims leaving Islam. As I always say, Muslims, and as the Prophet actually said, are as many as the foam on the waves of the rock when they crash, but we're as fickle and feeble as that foam, as that wave when it crashes into the rock. So yes, you know, the ability then to work through our traditions and to really understand other people's traditions as well, and to begin to establish those lines of relationships becomes very, very important insofar as our sense of humility and our contextualization of what happened and where we faltered during the pre-modern period and why we ended up being defeated ultimately near the end, you know, and not just simply with the Ottoman Empire, which is, you know, 1798 to, you know, 1801, 1803, something like that. But, you know, then direct colonization and so on and so forth. So, and divide and conquering and conquest and so on. But it also lets us escape the binaries of situations whereby I, as a Muslim in the contemporary, have to either choose between a Zionist Wahhabi American, Euro-American imperialist alliance, or, sorry to say it this way, an aspiring Chinese, Russian, Iranian project. But I want to exclude like Iran, and I'm even going to exclude, because Iran's project through Wilayat al-Faqih was never really to achieve its state. It ultimately wanted to achieve that ummah. And that at a certain point is going to clash, if it isn't ideologically already, with Russia and China. So we can sit down and leave Hezbollah and in a certain sense, Islamic Jihad and other movements and even the Houthis, because these are still movements in a certain sense, despite maybe Hezbollah is exceptional because it does have amal and sort of political power within the state that way. But nonetheless, it considers it to be a movement of resistance. So there are Muslim movements and Islamist movements. The problem has and continues to become, what are the political ethical foundations that inform those movements? Whether it's Daesh, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's Hezbollah, and so on. And the ability to reconfigure that in a horizontalist, social justice, queer, feminist, anti-authoritarian, capitalist trajectory to achieve holistic social justice that we're constantly striving for.
Yes, well, that is certainly the task. One other component of your very stimulating book is also chapter 4 on anti and non-capitalist Islam. We've talked about the non-nation state orientation,
right,
anti and non-authoritarian dimensions, but you've only briefly alluded so far in our conversation to some of your critique through anarcha-Islamic ijtihad of capitalism and how you ground your kind of economic analysis, what sort of Quran of the oppressed you discover when it comes to the questions of social and economic equality. What did you find in your rereading of these concepts?
So first of all, the very etymological and ontological meaning of property is very different in Islam than certainly in capitalism, right? In the Protestant ethic of capitalism, this property is mine. It is a gift from God. I earned it. It belongs to me. And if you're poor, you're poor. Just sucks. In Islam, no. Property and mulk, as we know, mulk all belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All property belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, including our own bodies and what we do with them, let alone our possessions within itself. And if we misuse these possessions, then we're held accountable. But there's also a level of accountability that exists on this earth right here, right now. So property is not strictly private property, and everybody needs to be provided for, because Islam considers then social commodities such as, you know, shelter, food, water, minerals, as resources that belong to the entire ummah, to go back to that term. It is not something exclusively to be left to a bunch of Arab Gulf monarchies or this or that corporation. We live through 6 or 7 corporations through our entire lives and so on and so forth. So where is the istiqlal al-dhati, or the autonomy in that sense? And hence the failure of even, you know, third worldism, pan-Arabism, pan-Africanism that way, using a vehicle as the state, despite the fact that the master schools will never dismantle the master's house. Other concepts then become like, because these are, we have to also understand that the concept that I'm about to speak of are inseparable from the anti-authoritarian, non-authoritarian. They work in dynamic relationship to one another, the political with the economic, always. So other concepts, for instance, I begin to talk about that return within understanding of how property functions within Islam is khulafa, and how we're all caretakers of one another. But then we look at things like the forbiddance of interest, riba, in Islam, and the different forms, regardless of the form that the riba takes place, right? Riba in banks, riba on our food, on our clothing, on what we buy, and so on and so forth. And then we have counter, and of course it's strictly forbidden with Islam, and it's a central pillar to capitalism. Then we have Ramadan, right? Ramadan is not just this ritual in which Muslims abstain from food, from practicing or engaging in intimacy and water and so on throughout the day, but rather is meant for Muslims who can engage in fasting, although there are many different forms of fasting, and we have to acknowledge that, because we don't want to be ableist either. in which one is to feel the plight of the poor, to feel their hunger, to feel their pain. And not upon its completion, one is to pay zakah, which is not some benevolent alms charity at whatever percentage now that the authorities that tell us, oh, this percent of your income or whatnot. Rather, the community needs to be sufficient. It needs to be sustained. And the zakah is not to be given vis-a-vis a third party. It's supposed to be given face to face so that you look the homeless, the poor person in the eyes, and you again to feel their plight. And when you give them the money, it's not you giving them money, you hold your hand out with the zakah. And the other individual, the poor person, takes that money because it is the right of the poor over those who are better off. It is not some benevolent, again, charity that is to be given at a whim, and the Quran very much staunchly is against that. And those who are arrogant in giving it or are doing it out of a sense of pride, this is not yours or ours to begin with. But then there are other concepts like mudaraba and shimusharaka, in which how cooperative systems occur within Islam. If I wanted to engage in a new project, for instance, that benefits the community with regard to this innovative idea that I have that requires this piece of land, how then I need to go to the community, how shura needs to be exercised, a project needs to be laid down in its foundations, but ultimately that other caretakers can be involved in this project as time goes by and other caretakers to leave. We have the modern concept of Islamic banking, but I also critique that because it represents an, you know, an island of halal in an ocean of haram, because it really does nothing, despite the fact that, yeah, it may be better off in terms of like the fact that equity sharing. So if I go to an Islamic bank and I say I have this project and the Muslim bank signs off of it, that means we become partners. So if I lose, the bank loses. It's not like regular banking systems. But the idea and the model of that was actually based on Baytul Mal that existed within Islam, which was, you know, literally more or less a governance place, a house whereby anybody who's poor, anybody who's in need of food, anybody who's in need of money, etc., would go about and seek what it is that they need in order to, again, sustain their quality of life and not just basic necessities. So I get into these that I named and certainly more insofar as, again, informing the foundation for an egalitarian circulatory dynamic economic system, inheritance laws within Islam. You know, I sit down and talk about that, for instance, right? How, you know, again, we don't choose, or at least Muslims are not supposed to choose per se, you know, exclusively. And inheritance laws are quite complicated, obviously, because of the manifestation of different familial dynamics. So this is, again, part of the beauty of Islam. Insofar as its manifestation, but rather how that money is distributed horizontally as opposed to vertically, strictly through one's skin. No, some has to go to your extended family, some goes to the community, and so on and so forth. Again, to horizontalize matters a little more. Of course, there are going to be distinctions insofar as some people want to work, other people want to work less. So there will be disparities, but that doesn't mean that one will get to the extent where one is a billionaire and somebody else has absolutely nothing and is living on, you know, as in the case of Egypt, 60% or whatever is not only illiterate, or I think it was actually 60% illiterate, around 30 to 40% underneath the line of poverty, living on less than $2 a day. So you wouldn't get to that degree of totalitarian economic injustice. And that can simply be done by, again, placing band-aid solutions on banks, on companies and on corporations, and simply diversity taxes, hiring practices. It is not about the upward mobility of facilitating that. It is about actually facilitating that on a horizontal level, such that the community knows and understands its responsibility towards other members of its community as part of the broader ummah. So yeah, those become some of the anti-capitalist or non-capitalist practices, concepts that I begin to lay, again, the foundation for, building upon other Muslim economic theorists and so on that have been grappling with, how does one do this in the contemporary? But of course, what they're not considering is the question of the state, of authority, of international orders, and the limitation of thinking through prisms as, yeah, Muslim banks, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, we've been going for a while. We could just continue, right? Because there's so much and we could go into details of the specifics, but that's for the readers. I really want to encourage listeners and viewers to go get the book. It is, again, if it can be seen here, my screen isn't working. There we go. Islam and Anarchism, Relationships and Resonances by Muhammad Abdu. You will definitely find it interesting, challenging of your taken for granted views on what Islam is, and I think a very stimulating read and an opportunity to really, you know, more fully rethink what it means to be a Muslim in the modern world and what kinds of ethical and political and social commitments follow from it. It's fascinating. I really thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with people and for coming and talking with me about it, because it's always a very stimulating and enjoyable conversation that teaches me many things. And I hope that readers will engage with this work. And, you know, regardless of where they come down on some of the interpretations, they should take it seriously and engage it. Because you've thought through a lot of key questions and are making a case for a really systematic re-understanding of how to interpret Islam. So thank you very much for doing this work.
Thank you, and thank your generous audience for their engagement. But really, my gratitude. You've been my elder. You've taught me so much. So I'm also very much grateful for you and your wisdom and your teaching, as well as so many BIPOC scholars. And I sincerely hope that this book ultimately benefits the meek of the earth, because that's what the Quran of the Oppressed is supposed to deal with. It's supposed to directly address in materialist ways and not just simply in theoretical ivory tower, you know, reflective thoughts. So again, I'm very humbled and honored. And thank you very much.
Well, listeners, again, the book is Islam and Anarchism, Relationships and Resonances by Muhammad Abdu. You can find it, I think, at good bookstores. It is published by Pluto Press. It's out very recently, earlier this summer. Do check it out and look forward to further conversations in the Majlis. We'll be back next time. Until then, Assalamu alaikum, peace to everyone.
Thank you for joining us in the Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Majlis.